Welcome to Fishy Work, a podcast on ecologies, labour and fish governance. Today we're talking with Melissa Marschke and Peter van der Geest about working conditions in industrial fishing. Welcome to the first ever episode of Fishy Work. My name's Ian. Join me this season as we cast off into a sea of trash fish, worker precarity, racism and labour campaigns, to name but a few of the topics we'll find stranded and floating in the sea, calling out to have a podcast made about them. But you may ask, why are they calling out to have podcasts made about them? What's so interesting about labour at sea? Well, because it turns out many of us, including me, don't know much about the work or the workers who catch the fish that many of us eat. Sure, you might have a vague sense that there's overfishing. It pops up in the news with semi-regularity. And maybe you have a romantic idea about fishing. Ideas about gruff men with impressive beards and weathered hands and chunky jumpers who are lashed by rain for weeks at sea before returning to their homely wives at shore. If you excuse me as I adjust my Western-centric point of view for the moment, your romantic images might actually be of gangs of men with wide shorts and wider smiles casting nets across Southeast Asia. Or maybe it's the case that you know there's something fishy going on. You might have vague memories of media reports about abuse in the industry, even whisper it quietly, forced labour that you try not to think about so much as you bite into your tuna sandwiches. But there's lots going on beyond romance, scandals, and vague guilt. In this podcast, we want to take you a little deeper and speak to people who have cast a critical eye over ecologies, labour, and fish governance. We're not looking to be sensationalist, although many of the stories you hear are sensational, nor do we want to make you feel bad about whatever you put into your mouth. What you do at your dinner time is your own business. But rather, I want to learn about fish and work through a series of discussions with researchers who have dedicated a good deal of their lives making sense of it all, and then share these discussions with you. And in this very first episode, we couldn't have had a better couple of people to invite for a discussion. I sat down with Melissa Marschke, a professor at the School of International Development and Global Studies at the University of Ottawa, Canada, and Peter van der Geest, professor emeritus at York University, which is also in Canada. You're going to find out much more about them and their work as things move along, so I won't tell you more about them now, but safe to say I really, really, really enjoyed our conversation. We spoke about what structures working conditions at sea, why it can be so bad, and yet why fishing is still meaningful for many fisher folk. We also spoke about how researchers go about researching labour at sea and what organisations, campaigners and unions are doing to help improve working conditions. Stick around after the interview, because in this episode, just as in each and every episode, I'll be joined by fishing and labour expert Alan Kadfak to briefly tell us what you and I just learnt and why it's important. So it gives me really, really great pleasure to have both Melissa and Peter here with us. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Hi, Melissa. How are you doing?
Well, thanks. Hi, Ian.
And you, Peter. How are you doing down there in your basement, it seems?
I'm doing great. I'm actually on the second floor enjoying the nice spring weather here.
Okay. I don't know why it looks like a basement, maybe the angle. So in preparation for our conversation, I've been reading quite a bit of your work, and as I was doing so, and in learning about the working conditions of those who labour at sea, the old British proverb got stuck in my head: worse things happen at sea. And I know it's something that we say to people to make them feel better about the bad thing that's just happened to them, but nevertheless, it kept bouncing around my brain. I was thinking about the terrible conditions in many globalised industries, and I was thinking about them, and I was thinking, wow, it's bad there, but worse things happen at sea. And I was going to ask that as my first question. I was thinking maybe that is a good question to kick off our discussion. Why do worse things happen at sea? But in time, I realized it was a bad question because it's a bit reductive. It's impossible to compare. And maybe things I don't know, aren't even that bad. So I hope I have a better question to kick us off today, which is, when thinking about work and workers, what are the conditions that allow for so many bad things to happen at sea?
I think fish work is absolutely dangerous, and that wouldn't be disputed. And that's because fishers, whether you're fishing near home or you're out on the high seas, you're working on a moving platform with sharp equipment, with ropes, with other gear. There's waves, there can be intense storms. So it's a mobile platform. You're constantly moving and hauling in gear with fish, or you're setting nets. And so I think nobody would dispute that it's quite dangerous and there's a occupational health and safety thing. But what has also been happening in recent years is that working conditions in some fisheries have absolutely declined, especially those further out on the high seas, not only, but especially there. And so that's when you're hearing stories of forced labor. You're hearing stories of examples of forced labor would include passports being confiscated, having funny contracts, violence on the boat, which can be both physical and verbal, long working hours, 20-hour days being the norm, not having enough food rations, on and on it goes. And over time, this has been increasingly a migrant workforce that's been out at sea.
So about a month ago, I did some interviews for our national public radio. And one of the interviewers threw me with a question. He said, well, what about all those TV shows where you have these men out working on fishing vessels and having a great time, and everybody loves these shows, and it all seems like just a really wonderful thing to be doing? And, you know, I didn't know what to answer. I kind of said something about masculinities and romanticization and how the reality of fishing is not like that. But I think the other side of it is actually that for a lot of people, fishing is a really rewarding occupation. And when you think about small-scale fishers, especially people who go out on a daily basis, who, for whom it's a family occupation, and maybe in some places around the world where I work in coastal Thailand, people have returned to fishing. They used to work for the big fishing boats and they just didn't like being yelled at by captains and not being in control through life. So they've returned to local small-scale fishing. The livelihood may not be as good, but it's something where they can control their own lives. They go out in small boats with family members and they provide food for the communities. Much of what they produce is actually consumed locally. And it's really important to remember that there is a fisheries out there that is really important for people's food security, and it provides a rewarding occupation. That's not the fisheries we're talking about in our research. We're talking about the big industrial deep sea fisheries, which has really increasingly turned to migrant workers and to low paid migrant workers, and has been structured into the seafood industry. And so I think what you're finding is pressure everywhere to turn to migrant workers, paid very little money, which produces also racial hierarchies on vessels. It means that the captain might be white or might be Chinese. The workers are from Indonesia and the Philippines. And that increases the likelihood of those workers being treated very badly, basically out of a kind of a racism. So that's really the kind of fisheries we're talking about. The other side of it is that fisheries are excluded from most national labor regulations and codes. This is something that is common for both fisheries and agriculture, but is especially extreme in fisheries because of fisheries, especially the big industrial fisheries that operate out on the high seas. There, you know, a lot of countries say, look, they're fishing outside of our national territory, so therefore we don't have to apply minimum wage or, you know, overtime hours and all that kind of stuff. And also, when you're out there, of course, nobody's monitoring you. So the captain can come back and fill out a logbook and say, well, this worker worked, you know, 12 hours or 14 hours a day, which is actually what the ILO Workers in Fishing Convention says, when in reality, they're working 18 or 20 hours a day. And it happens all the time. I don't think any logbook around the world in these industrial fishing vessels is filled out accurately from what we've seen, because we've seen them. So you're kind of out of sight. It's very hard to monitor and regulate, and you're excluded from most basic labor laws and conventions.
I think at work, when I used to work at a university, when I had to fill in my timesheets, that was also a work of fiction as well, but it was for a different reason. that was to hide self-exploitation and overwork. But I'm fascinated by the sort of the racial divisions or ethnic divisions within the workforce and the increased use that you talked about, both of you, of migrant labor. And I suppose for many people who have no idea about what, you know, a large scale fishing vessel might look like, the question might be, how's that come about? What are the mechanisms in place that allow for, you know, a white captain and a Thai or Filipino or Indonesian workforce to be working there? Who's involved in making that happen, or what are the systems and processes in place?
Well, maybe you have to start by thinking about the main distant water fleets right now. The largest fleet in the world is China, followed by Taiwan, Japan, Korea, and Spain. So those are the top five distant water fleets. And those fleets, particularly the Chinese fleet, has increased rapidly in the past decade, in part in response to this need for seafood and processing hubs and exporting to various markets, including Europe and North America. Those boats will have a captain. The captain is not always the same nationality as the flag of the boat. So say a boat was built in Japan and then sold to Taiwan. So it would be flying with a Japanese flag, but it would be a Taiwanese company owning the boat with a Taiwanese captain. And then they would need a workforce. And this is the kind of work that many people don't want to do. And so you asked about why migrant workers? Well, it's because national workers these days don't want to do this kind of work. And so it's been a turn to low wage countries like Indonesia and the Philippines, where there's good recruitment infrastructure and where even though the pay is super low, we've seen contracts for $250 up to $550, $600 for someone that's worked a little bit longer in the industry. That's better pay than if you were working as a fisher, say, in Indonesia or the Philippines. And so there's a reason people get attracted to the work, but it doesn't mean it's good work. And in fact, these conditions have to radically change. So when you talk to the worker, they need the money. It's not working back home, you know, unless we were to find a way to pay fishers better in small scale fisheries. But the working conditions absolutely have to change. And so that's part of the fight that's going on around forced labor and violence at sea. We talked to some crew that had been out at sea because of COVID for up to 4 years at a time. Can you imagine being on a boat?
Wow.
You don't speak the same language as your captain. You don't have access to Wi-Fi and you're rarely coming into port. And so you're not connecting with family at all. And then you come in and you're rattled because something has happened back at home. It's brutal. Or someone's sick on the boat. I heard cases of guys that had toothaches, which start out as really minor, but there's no medicine on the boat and it gets worse and worse and they get back on land and they have to have a tooth yanked. I heard another case of someone with a stomach ache. It turned out to be stomach cancer and he'd been asking to leave the boat for weeks and weeks and the captain didn't let him. So the captain really controls things on the boat. And as Peter mentioned, it's out of sight, out of mind. There's very little monitoring going on the high seas. And so the captain's rule really makes a difference. And so if you've got a captain that's kind and ethical and finds a way when transshipment is having to send a worker back to shore, that's great. But we're unfortunately hearing a lot of cases where workers are being overworked and hugely exploited. And that's the piece we're quite concerned about.
Just to kind of step in, one of the things that we've been looking at, drawing really on migration scholarship, is the availability of an infrastructure to recruit workers, right? So that's what migration scholars talk about a lot. Migration doesn't just happen. You need the people who recruit. You need ways of sending people overseas, getting them to the vessels. And so in the case of the Philippines, it was already there because the Philippines have long supplied workers for seafaring in general, also for kind of cargo vessels. And so what it means is that many of those crewing agencies that were supplying and continue to supply a lot of workers to cargo vessels are now also supplying workers for fishing vessels. And if you look at, for example, some of what's happening right now with the vessels being sunk out in the Middle East, and you look carefully at who those workers are, I think you'll see Philippine workers probably. Many of them would be, not all, also Eastern European workers and the like. The way those workers get to their vessels is the same as the way workers get to fishing vessels. However, within the Philippines, work on those cargo vessels is considered way better than work in fishing vessels because you'd much rather be on a cargo vessel because there you're going to be in port more often. You're covered by the Maritime Labor Convention from which fishing is excluded. And so there's a certain amount of regulation that goes on. You have access to Wi-Fi, which you generally don't on when you're on fishing vessels. And so there's a kind of a hierarchy within the Philippines in terms of where you're likely to end up. Some of the crewing agencies we talk to, what they do is they'll make workers go and work on fishing vessels for a stint or two before they open them on a cargo vessel as a way of just kind of getting some workers for the fishing vessels. Indonesia is a bit different. We've been tracing also the evolution of a crewing agency infrastructure. It started with Taiwanese vessels showing up in 1980s, 1990s. At that time, they were more using Chinese labor. Labor they would pick up in mainland China. But they started picking up workers directly in Indonesia. as they passed through. And then from that, you also had the development of this infrastructure of crewing agencies, who are often considered by many to be some of the worst exploiters, because very often the workers are not paid directly. The vessel owners will pay the crewing agencies, who then pay the workers. And along the way, those crewing agencies will deduct many different kinds of fees. And this is one of the biggest complaints of these workers, because they are there in the end to make an income for their families, to support their families. That's the main reason they're working. They're not getting any direct enjoyment out of this themselves, per se. And so when they get a lot of deductions for fees and other kinds of things, that is a big problem for them. So those crewing agents really are kind of dominant players in the whole system, and often are kind of what people sort of target as being one of the main exploiters, along with the vessel owners, because they control so much of that whole system. I've heard that, for example, when a crew member dies, this is what I heard in Indonesia from some of our researchers there, if a crew member dies while fishing, it's considered winning the lottery for the crew, for the crewing agencies. That's the way they talk about it informally. Why is that? Because it's required that those workers now have insurance. But the insurance money doesn't go directly to the family. It goes to the crewing agency, and then they send some of it to the family, but they keep a lot of it themselves. So that's kind of an example of the way those crewing agencies are able to kind of leverage their middleman role in order to really make a nice income for themselves. They all have nice houses, they drive nice cars, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of attention in Indonesia to the role of the crewing agencies and how they can be maybe taken out of a lot of these kinds of middleman roles. For example, paying workers directly is one way of doing it, paying insurance money directly, all these kinds of things.
It's been so hard to regulate, and everybody says it's someone else's responsibility. So middle person agencies in Indonesia, or the Philippines, the recruitment agencies, that's national. If you think about the company that owns the boat, that's another nationality. It depends what port a boat lands on. A boat from Korea could land in South Africa and then keep going towards the Falkland Islands and stop at several ports here and there as they fuel and offload and change crew. And so it's multiple jurisdictions, and it's very easy to blame someone else. Oh, I heard that poor worker, but I can't do anything. And so this is part of the problem, is a captain will appear empathetic if confronted and say, well, really, that's the recruitment agency. A recruitment agency will do the same about the boat and the captain. And so this really, there's ways to solve it. Peter made a point about direct payment is a great way, not confiscating passports, having proper visas as you go in and out of port. There's ways to handle all of this, but it's a dodgy system with lots of opaqueness at the moment.
I want to get on to some of the ways in which people are organizing to improve conditions in a while. But before we do, I mean, you mentioned it's a hard thing to regulate. I imagine it's also quite a difficult thing to research because it's distant, because there's so much exploitation going on, like maybe people don't want to let researchers in. So maybe that's a good part of the conversation to explore a little bit more about maybe methodology or positionality or your careers as researchers. I want to know about how you get into researching such a topic. And I mean this in both those two ways, both as personal and methodologically. You know, what led you to labor and fishing as researchers, as people, right? And how do you go about finding out what you find out?
Great question. So much of my earlier work was in Cambodia, and it was with small scale fishers. And I was looking a lot at small scale fishing livelihoods, the struggles fishers were having as fish in general were declining on the coast, and forms of community management. So were there ways to better manage the fishery, etc.? And one of the frustrations was, as much as local communities were doing, there was still trawls further out at sea affecting the fish stock. And so it was a lot of work that they were putting in, and there were for sure some wins. You can do tree replanting, you can have fish sanctuaries, but the bigger picture, stocks were still declining. And at the same time, I was seeing some fancy houses go up in the village, and I was hearing that it was from workers that had been in Thailand on the fishing boats. But I'd never really probed what that meant to be in Thailand on the fishing boat. And then in 2013-14, we started hearing murmurings that actually for migrant laborers, for Cambodian and Burmese laborers, it could be horrific conditions, including examples of human trafficking, but also men that were dying at sea, men that were being burned with cigarettes. Like, we were starting to hear really upsetting stories. And that's when Peter and I connected on this because of his work in Thailand. And we realized that we could actually do port work with migrant Cambodian workers in Thailand to start hearing about their experiences. And so part of the work was to find out what the heck is going on. Because on the one hand, I'd seen these amazing houses being built. And on the other hand, I was hearing these horrible stories. And so what gave? And it was both that there's really horrible things going on in the Thai fisheries, and some people were making it and able to make a profit and felt it was worthwhile. So we were trying to really talk with workers and understand, what is it about this work? When is it working? When is it not? How would you want to change your working conditions? And so it really started with that port work in Thailand to do the research on labor. Maybe I'll let Peter jump in before thinking about the bigger expansion of the project.
Well, I think, you know, I was thinking about that question, and it really just depends on how far back you want to go in our careers. Like, how did I end up being a retired professor who spent his life looking at very broadly development studies and marginalized people in Asia? And it had a lot to do, I think, originally. I have a degree in chemical engineering. This wasn't my original career, but I ended up not wanting to, you know, work in a oil and gas industry the rest of my life in a small town with a lot of industry. So I went off to Thailand and I taught engineering for 3 years. And that's how I started my engagement with Thailand, and also started my engagement with development studies, and ended up getting a PhD in the field and spending my life teaching and doing research in that. And it really comes out of a curiosity of wanting to know about the world, but also really being interested in the lives of marginalized people. And most of my life, I worked on actually forestry issues and how forestry policies limits local people's access to forests for livelihood purposes. I spent many years writing and researching on that topic. But I also, my research was actually in a coastal village where I started doing my research on for my PhD, where I spent many years. And then that coastal fishing, there was also a lot of small scale fishing. And so that also kept my feet in the question of fishing. And so when that scandal in 2014 came along, We had just actually gotten a research grant, me and Melissa, to do research on both fishing and forestry issues. We basically abandoned the forestry side of the research project and jumped headlong into the fisheries because it was such an important and compelling topic. And we felt like, apart from the media coverage, which tends to pick up the worst case scenarios, and there were some really awful things going on, we thought there was really a need to step back and try to figure out, what about the lives of your ordinary everyday migrant worker in fisheries? How are they experiencing these problems? And to write about that and to write about the reforms in that way. So that's how we got into it. Our next step then was, okay, we realized that a lot of the seafood exports from Thailand are actually being sourced internationally. Most of the raw materials being imported, and a lot of it is tuna from, in this case, Taiwan, and that many of the workers in the Taiwanese fisheries are from Indonesia and the Philippines. And we are both Southeast Asian, so that made sense. So we thought, the next project, we thought, okay, we'll just do that. We'll add Taiwan to our research. And that was just as COVID started. So we couldn't do the field work that we wanted to do. So what did we do? We started doing Zoom calls with support organizations in ports around the world, particularly Stella Maris chaplains, who are amazing people. And they are the ones who, on an everyday basis, when a fish worker is having a problem, they will often go to the seafarer centers in ports, if they can get to port, and they will go to the Stella Maris. This is the Catholic organization, and they provide support of various kinds. So you don't have to be Catholic to go to them. So they provide support in these major fishing ports all around the world, and they really know what's going on, what the problems are. So we started doing Zoom calls with them. And from there, we started also working with ITF, the International Transport Workers Federation, who also provides a lot of support for fish workers. So in a sense, COVID kind of pushed us to become more global. And that's how we ended up doing what we are right now. Most of our interviewing of workers is with the help of these support organizations and in parts. So that's how we do it. We also had a graduate student, Mallory McDonald, who was able to spend some time in Taiwan during the pandemic, because at that time there was no COVID. And she spent a lot of time just sitting with workers, going through their daily work routine. Like, what do you do when when do you wake up? When do you work? When do you eat? What's the nature of the work? What's the danger? And they showed them videos, because these workers take videos of their own work. And so she observed videos. We can't go on the vessels. Our research protocols won't allow us to do that. It wouldn't be considered safe. But there's a lot you can learn just by talking with workers in detail, and also talking with the support organizations.
Yeah, we've also had graduate students in Vietnam looking at the blue boat fisheries. So that's an example of a fishery that's not out in the high seas, but blue boats tend to go past Vietnamese waters and are often caught, say, in Indonesia or Malaysia. And it's a less studied workforce. But even there, we know there's no formal contracts. It's a masculine space. The guys are out for a month at a time. And the will of the captain is huge there. It really matters. So we've done that. And we've had another graduate student work in Canada, starting to look at if Canada has a distant water fisheries and if they use migrant workers in our inshore fisheries. We don't, but we do for our seafood processing. So we've been trying to puzzle through here back at home a little bit our own workforce. So we work with graduate students. As Peter said, we work with organizations, the International Labor Organization, the International Transport Federation, and then these key port actors, Stella Maris being rather incredible, to really allow access. I was able to spend 4 months in South Africa working with one of the port chaplains and do a lot of interviews with crew coming through Cape Town Port. And that was really powerful, just to have the time to sit, to learn. And you might ask, well, why are they even interested to work with us? They're already doing their welfare support work. And I think it was partly that it was a chance for us to co-learn together. We were looking at the lives of these workers, and many have been working in fisheries for 30 years, and they've had experiences on multiple boats. And so being able to compare and contrast and look at the current moment and talk about how they manage the hardships at sea, which are really hard, and then meet other workers who are like, I'm out. I'm going home. This is too much. So just getting the variety and the contrast, and being able to also give some support to an organization like Stella Maris has also been really great. So it's not just for research, but it's about a co-learning and moving forward, because ultimately we want to nudge these fisheries to be better. Like, that's the bigger game.
Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty interesting, because I imagine for most people who are researchers in the social sciences more broadly, it's not always the case that you have, first of all, interested, you know, civil society or labor organizations that want to work with researchers, and also media attention on the topic as well. And I imagine journalists are also wanting to know about, you know, what you found out and so on. I imagine, and for someone who doesn't work in such a field at all, that it's both has its positives that you spoke about then, that, you know, you can co-learn and so on and so forth, but maybe also its dangers. You might upset people, you might suggest things that they think are different if you're coming from outside, or am I wrong in that assertion?
I can at least say for myself, I didn't come to doing the media work very easily. Even a podcast like this, it's not my forte. I love learning with workers. I'm happy at a local level. I love writing. I'm happy to share papers. But over time, it's just become clear that we have to speak about it. There's no choice. It's an important set of insights we have. And people, thanks to the great work of journalists and others, people are starting to pay attention to this and are wanting to nudge it forward. And we've had this privilege of speaking with workers and have these insights. And so I think it's important that we share what we understand. And yeah, it probably does make certain sectors unhappy, maybe especially here in Canada, because in Canada, I don't think we've really figured it out. And so we're not getting a great response when we kind of nudge and make points for the Canadian government to do better on, you know, seafood supply chains and sourcing. We're just getting a cold face right now. we're starting to make a few inroads. And I think that's the goal, is to say, look, we have a responsibility to do better on this. Our seafood supply chains have forced labor in it, and we have to shift that. And so, yeah, I guess the next period of time will show. I think it helps that Peter is retired and is dedicated, but he's not. Like, he's full-time on this in a way that I can't be, because I'm still teaching and doing admin. And so if anything, we're getting more momentum now because he's able to just focus on this in a sustained way.
Well, my main concern about being retired is that I'm not finding enough time yet for walking and gardening and, you know, canoeing and all the stuff I actually like to do. I work half days. I don't work full days. Yeah, those moments do come up where we might do an analysis of something that's a bit different from what some NGOs might be doing. So we tend to reject often the more, I don't want to use a negative term, but let's say the highlighting of some of the worst cases, and we tend to back off and say, let's look at the general situation and what's the best way forward. So for example, we tend to, as an actual strategy for pursuing bad cases, we tend to not be very much in favor of the anti-trafficking approach, because it's a criminalization approach, and you're not going to get labor justice through criminalizing bad crewing agencies or bad vessel owners. You're going to get labor justice through approaching that through labor laws. Unfortunately, labor laws tend to be kind of weak or not applicable, right? So this is the dilemma. But we don't feel like blaming bad actors is the best approach. What you need to do is look at the broader systemic problems. And not everybody in the, what we might broadly call civil society sector, for example, anti-slavery campaigns and so on, have that approach. They tend to focus sometimes on bad actors rather than the more systematic problems. And so, but in those situations, we really do try to be supportive and saying, you know, this is, we need to go after these things. And here are some alternative ways of thinking about it that might be more useful than, for example, a criminalization approach. There are some other places where I think we just have to tread carefully. If we really feel like we're going to undermine the good work of an organization, it was something we say, we just don't say it. Right? You can, there's different ways of communicating and discussing things with people. On the whole, though, I'd say our relationship with the organizations we've been working with have been really positive. Organizations like ITF, the International Transport Workers Federation, and Celemaris will probably be our key organizations. And organizations like ITF, they know what they're doing. They are very smart, astute people. I'm in awe of some of the things that they've been able to accomplish, actually.
We started off our discussion being quite, we're talking about some of the conditions that have created some pretty bad working conditions, and you gave some examples of some pretty horrific cases, as well as talking about the broader structures. And we've started to touch a little bit on how some of these organizations are trying to address these issues. But I'd like to sort of move in a sort of final part of our conversation to be maybe a little bit more optimistic and maybe looking a little bit more into the future. Because on one hand, a cynic might say, well, you know what? It's just another globalized industry with lots of exploitation. The same when I buy my telephone, you know, it's probably, you know, there's probably forced labor in that, the same here, there, etc., and so on. So I hesitate to ask the question, you know, what is to be done? But basically, this is sort of my, sort of where I'm coming from. Like, what can be done, if anything, or what is being done in this sector to try and improve the working conditions of those who labor at sea?
Well, lots can be done. In fact, that's probably what gives me a lot of hope. It's filled with potential. And at the same time, lots needs to be done. So we both mentioned the International Transport Federation. We had the privilege of working with them in Ireland, looking at their campaign work for migrant workers. And through a 10-year sustained campaign that was media savvy, that used vessel tracking data, that worked with migration lawyers, that looked at contracts, that understood recruitment policies, they argued that migrant workers coming into Ireland's fishery, they were being paid half of what European Union workers were making. And they were able to show that. They were able to show that they were working excess hours, and that the boat owners who were claiming a 39-hour standard work week, that it just wasn't true. And so recently, Ireland has actually changed its policy. And so migrant workers will be on the same footing as EU workers, which is a really important win. And they will be paid a proper wage with the rights towards citizenship after 5 years. So it's huge. And it's an example of a savvy, smart, dogged campaign over a decade that made a difference. And they persisted. So that has been really exciting to watch and to learn from. Their bigger goal is unionization, but they're thinking thoughtfully about where to start in different contexts. And they have the ITF, they've done more work globally in cargo, but as they move forward in fishing, they're looking at different parts of the world and have a number of fisheries officers. If anything, they just don't have enough folks to do the good work that they do. So that's one example of an organization that's really hopeful. In the Canadian scene, we could be watching what's happening in Europe with the due diligence policy, right? That came through at the European level. I think a number of countries contested it recently, the due diligence policies. And so
Just maybe tell us what that is.
It's mandatory human rights due diligence policy. This is actually policy that governs supply chains. So companies have to adhere to, and it has both labor policy and environmental policy together. It's twinned. And that's what makes it so exciting, because it doesn't separate out working conditions and environmental decline. So you can imagine for seafood where, yes, there's overfishing, but there's also this labor exploitation. So it's something that really will work in the case of many commodities, including seafood. And the European Union has the first kind of advanced policy on it that's, you know, still contentious within the EU, but it's moving forward. And so I think Canada could look towards seeing how these due diligence policies work, how companies respond, if auditing is done in a more careful, thoughtful way. So those are some of the spaces to watch that give hope and where you could see other countries following.
Just want to also mention the really amazing early work of Greenpeace, also Environmental Justice Foundation, but especially Greenpeace, because they were the first among all the kind of environmental organizations to include human rights and labor justice in their definition of sustainability. And, you know, starting way back about 15 years ago or something like that. And I think their influence in this has been huge. So they will not talk about sustainable fisheries without also talking about the workers on those fishing vessels. And it's really to their credit that they've been doing this, and they've been doing this in a sustained way for quite a long time now. It's part of what pulled us into it as well, initially, even though we don't work directly with Greenpeace at the moment. Environmental Justice Foundations, we have a relationship with them in Thailand. So I think that's a big part of it, is like, don't just worry about sustainable fisheries. Think about both sustainable fisheries and human rights and labor rights. And often the same infrastructure that is being put in place to try to monitor fisheries and regulate fisheries can be mobilized to also look at, to monitor what's happening with workers. But then there's another danger there, which is that if you only have top-down regulation, it's in the end not going to be effective. Because the thing to remember is that when you're on a fishing vessel, you're really vulnerable to the captain. There's a whole history. People talk about the captain being kind of the embodiment of the state. They really have this authority that you're not going to find in too many workplaces. And because you're at sea for such a long time, workers are very vulnerable. So what you really need is a way for workers to be able to bring forth grievances in which they feel safe to do so. And our argument is that ultimately that's only really going to work through independent, preferably worker-based organizations, right? So an auditor is not going to find things. There's another organization called the Outlaw Ocean Project, which has been doing some really amazing work on some of this in relation to China, seafood processing and fisheries. And they've shown pretty clearly that just your basic audits do not work. So you need to find ways of organizing workers and having ways for them to get involved in regulating their own work conditions. I mean, my model is the collective agreement. I'm part of a union. Most of my workplace when I was still working was really regulated by our collective agreement, not by labor law per se, even though labor law was out there as well. So ideally, that would be the way forward. There are collective agreements being signed, for example, through crewing agencies in Indonesia. Unfortunately, many of those collective agreements simply become a new way of extracting fees from workers. So how do you make those kinds of unions more real and more actually working for workers? There's another campaign I want to mention that I think is an exemplary in a different way, which is the Global Labor Justice Organization in the US has been organizing what they call a Wi-Fi for Workers campaign. And so right now, many workers on distant water fishing vessels do not have access to Wi-Fi, even if the vessel has Wi-Fi. And there's a variety of reasons for that. I think the captains might be afraid that workers are going to spend more time on Wi-Fi and less time working. There's also arguments, it's expensive. There's fears. I'd say most fishing vessels, to some degree or another, engage in illegal fishing. It's not either or, it's there. They're catching species they shouldn't be catching, this kind of thing, and they're afraid that too much Wi-Fi would start to reveal some of that. I mean, who knows all the reasons why? But if workers were able to have access to Wi-Fi, for example, an hour a day, and by the way, workers in cargo vessels do get that access, it's part of the practice, and it's another way in which fishing workers are marginalized. It would, first of all, it enabled them to keep contact with their families. And this is something that is psychologically really difficult for workers in fishing, that they're out there at sea and they do not know what's going on with their families. And their families don't know what's going on with them. So that would relieve a lot of psychological and mental stress for workers. But the other thing is, once you get access to Wi-Fi, then you can start to communicate and potentially organize and contact support organizations. So it could be a real game changer to an ability to organize workers. It is very difficult to organize workers in fishing because of just the nature of the work, the fact that they're out at sea for so long and their inability to communicate. So this would overcome a key obstacle. Just one comment on Canada, on kind of how things can be more positive. Out in Newfoundland, which is one of our major fishing provinces on the East Coast, there has been a really strong militant union there for many, many decades. And that union has had a huge positive impact on work and fishing. Workers do often get organized on vessels and just basically say, look, we're not going to work anymore unless the captain stops beating us or this particular person, or we're going to stop fishing unless you give us better food. Or maybe, you know, don't work such extreme hours. This happens. We hear about this all the time. What doesn't happen so much is they then link up with support organizations or become unionized. It doesn't often take the next step. But the organizing does happen on a ship-to-ship basis. There is a sense when we talk to support organizations, I remember talking to, for example, a chaplain in Singapore where a lot of vessels stop for recrewing and resupply. He says that there's been a big change over the last, he's worked in this sector now for 20 years. And he says the last so many years, workers have become much more aware of their rights, so to speak, much more ready to go to support organizations. Vessel owners have become afraid to engage in some of the abusive practices that they used to. Now, I'm getting this in two different ways because I think that's probably more true of Philippine workers than Indonesian workers, because the Philippines just have more of a history of being mobilized and understanding their rights than people in Indonesia. Many of the results we're getting from talking to workers between contracts in Indonesia says they just don't get their rights. But, you know, that is basically means you, there's a lot of work to be done.
And I think, for example, the Taiwanese government has made huge efforts to work on improving conditions on its fleet and takes that quite seriously, as does Japan or Korea. So we know that certain fleets are realizing it's been problematic and they are trying to improve working conditions. So we'll have to keep nudging that along for all fleets.
Unfortunately, we're not hearing the same about the Chinese fleet so far, but they do have some concern about their international reputation, so who knows? And because of the Outlaw Ocean Project, I think more and more sanctions are going to be coming down on seafood exports from China.
Yeah, for sure.
And that makes a difference. That external pressure, actually, it really does make a difference. I mean, ultimately, the real reform has to come from both worker organizations and from the governments, you know, where the vessels are flagged and from which they're operated. Those are the most important ones, and perhaps the home state for the workers. But importing states, they can make a difference by putting pressure on where those seafood imports are coming from.
Importing states matter. We often think we're off the hook. Well, we don't have a big fleet. We're not doing the fishing. All we're doing is eating the seafood. Well, yeah, we're eating the seafood, and our seafood should not be tainted with forced labor. That is something that can make a difference.
You know, and what you and I buy, I often get this question. Okay, what seafood should I buy? My answer is usually buy whatever seafood you want. It's not going to make a difference. Your and I consumption choice. Although if you feel like, no, I don't want to buy seafood because I know this is might be going on with it, that's a great choice. I do make a point from trying to buy from ethical sources. I don't think that's going to change what we're talking about per se. It's just kind of my own ethical choice. But what does make a change is when you put pressure on the companies, the retailers, and on government to say you need stronger policies with respect to seafood imports and where you're obtaining your seafood from.
The structure has to change. It absolutely makes a difference for companies to be regulated and to be thinking about their supply. They claim it's free from tainted labor, and it's not. And so we have to do better. Companies have to do better. Importers have to do better. And it takes a whole variety of ways for that to actually happen.
If I wanted to sum up what we've been speaking about, it's the complexities of questions around exploitation and labor at sea. The response to that has to be equally complex. All of the things you've mentioned there around labor organizations, around international organizations, and around pressure on importing states and the companies as well. But I think our time has come to an end. We've been speaking for quite a bit. I think I could speak to you all day, because for me, this is absolutely fascinating because it's a totally new topic for me. But I have one last thing to do, which is to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for your interest in the topic.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Final part of the podcast, every single episode, I'm going to be speaking with Alin Kadvak, who's been researching and thinking about fishing and labor for a very long time. And she is the knot in the net of this podcast, the researcher who brings everything together. So it'd be really good, I think, if every single episode, after she's heard the interview, we check in with Alin and find out what we've learned and why it's important. But before we do that, I can say something, obviously, the CV type line of you, Alin, that you're a researcher at the Department of Rural and Urban Development, the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences in Uppsala, but that doesn't really tell us very much about you. Much more interesting, maybe for the listeners, might be to let us all know how me and you first met.
Yeah, where did we meet the first time? I think it was over at Tali in the middle of the day in Mangalore somewhere. I mean, you're vegetarian, so, but you know, I tried to pull you in to get you to eat fish curry and rava fried fish from Mangalore. So that was, you know, the excellent memories we had. So you and I met while we did research back those days in Karnataka, India.
2010, 11, somehow, yeah.
Yeah, it's more than 10 years, actually. So back then it was focusing more on, my work was focusing more on small scale fisheries, but now it's getting bigger.
Getting bigger. The fish are getting bigger or just or the research is getting bigger?
Sadly, fish is getting smaller, but but the research is getting bigger and, you know, move a bit away from small scale to commercial fishing.
So let's try this for the very first time then. You've just had a listen to the interview with Peter and Melissa. Can you tell the listeners what we have just learned?
I think two more things that, I will not add more into what they already, you know, already explained, but I think two take-homes messages will be, first thing, there's a very complexity of actors in this matter of trying to understand how to govern or how to support fish worker at sea. They have already mentioned, you know, frontline labor, NGO, states are important, supply chains are important, consultants are important. So, you know, how to fit the whole pictures with diverse actor and how to actually communicate with them and how to bring all of them together. That's the most challenging things I think for this work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the second point is I really would like to continue both of the emphasis on the frontliner NGO workers. I think, you know, we kind of a bit sadly still far away from having a very strong representative from the fish worker. So frontline NGO in each country is still very important to try to form union, to try to form a colleague bargaining activities and try to support the fish worker.
And so that's the two sort of big takeaways you've given us from the interview. Why do you think it's important?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the researcher always say that my research is so important and it's, you know, like it's the most important thing in the world.
Of course.
But of course, that is the key. But I mean, I think the title of this episode, we just have concluded that it's going to be making fish worker visible. And we have been trying to do that in the past, 8 years, because it has been invisible from the legislations, the public debate, you know, policy atmosphere. So I think we have to continue pushing fish worker to be more visible.
Thank you so much, Alin, for those two key takeaways and why it's important. Looking forward to speaking with you in a month's time, and I hope you get to eat some fish tali somewhere in Uppsala in the upcoming month.
Thank you, Ian.
Fishy Work is part of the Just Seafood Project, a collaboration between the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences in Sweden, the University of Ottawa in Canada, the Institute of Social Sciences of the Central Region, Vietnam, and the Cambodia Development Resource Institute in Cambodia. It's funded by the Swedish Research Council for Sustainable Development, FORMAS, and the Swedish Research Council, VR. The project's principal investigator is Dr. Alin Kadvak, and I've been your host, Ian M. Cook. Ta-ra!